The Afterbeat is always available for free on the iTunes Store, as well as at www.afterbeatpod.com. Afterbeat Pod is a Squarespace site. Squarespace, the new name and websites at www.squarespace.com. This is the Afterbeat with Rick Fleischman. Afterbeat number 9, the LA Jazz Collective and the Future of Jazz in Los Angeles with Ryan McGillicuddy and Gary Fukushima. So I've tried to keep the clean tag so that my students can listen. So
okay.
Don't use any of that foul language. I don't know whether my students are listening or not, but hopefully they will. Man, I'm getting a real glare from that.
No,
keep it there. So that's good. The guy who's keeping it there is Gary, and we got Ryan, and these are representatives of the LA Jazz Collective. Hi, guys.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
And Ryan is capsized a little bit in the sofa. The studio bears are looking over him, but he's a little under the weather, so.
Yeah.
So, who wants to tell me first what the LA Jazz Collective actually is?
Okay, I'll do that.
That's Gary.
I guess we're a arts organization that was created by jazz musicians, and as of right now, it's still operated by jazz musicians, mm-hmm. and we came together. Really to find a way to create a community that represented I guess the kind of music that we enjoy and we're trying to write and promote and essentially have an entity that was kind of larger than the individuals, that made up that entity.
Yeah.
And, in effect, be able to, kind of create a little bit more, attention to all of these individual artists, who frankly, are struggling and still struggling, to try to get their music heard. And, LA is, well, it's a big city, obviously, and there's a lot of music happening, but I think a lot of times the creative jazz music scene, even though it exists, is hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're trying to find ways to flesh that out, and make it a little more visible in Los Angeles.
Anything to add to that, Ryan?
No, I think that sums it up pretty well.
Yeah. So you guys saw a need that wasn't being filled by the other either institutions or the commercial establishments or the schools or something. Yes?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, it's a very well, I don't know. It's not a non-popular kind of music to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody recently about the indie rock scene here. And this woman who's a bass player was saying, indie rock is like such a niche part of just the general music scene. And you talk about them struggling and not doing well. But mm-hmm. for them, struggling would mean, your album only sells 500,000 copies,
Right.
And I was like, if any of us sold 500,000 copies of anything, we'd be dancing all over the place.
Yeah. Pretty much out of the question for a jazz artist who isn't George Benson.
Yeah. Totally, So it's not a big piece of the pie to begin with, And then on top of that, to try to do something that's even more, or I guess you say even less of a mainstream kind of thing, it's almost like there's no real good economic model for that to work. I guess we're trying to do an arts model for creative jazz. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you guys find or did you have a feeling that the kind of jazz you were playing or the kind of music you were playing, you weren't going to get booked? I mean, mostly this is around people who play the Blue Whale a lot, and we'll go into that a little more. But, I mean, did you feel like you were not going to get booked elsewhere there?
Yeah, well, I would say that at the... When we started this collective...
this is Ryan, by the way.
This is Ryan, yes. When we started the collective, I think the intent for a lot of us was like when I most of the work I do right now is as a sideman,
right.
And back then when we started the collective too, it was the case as well. And we noticed, I think, in general, unless you already have an established name or you've been on the scene, you know, as far as like locally or even nationally or internationally, unless you have like some kind of an established name or you've been around for a while, it was really difficult, I think, or a challenge for us to get booked at places that we would be able to play our original compositions.
Right.
So a lot of times, you know, it'd be, if I was on a gig, I would be the sideman. But, you know, when I wanted to do my own group mm-hmm. and wanted to play my own compositions, there wasn't a lot of areas to do that. And so, I guess one of the first places we started doing that at was Cafe Metropole, right? That was
downtown.
Downtown when that existed. We, at the outset with the group, we put on a couple festivals there. And one of the great things about having that collective together was we were able to pack the place.
Yeah.
You know, there was like enough of people that wanted to come and hear that music that, you know, we had a good audience. And a lot of times when you are not an established name and you're not you don't have a big following and you want to go out and play those original compositions in this creative music, you might be playing to an audience of two.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, I can tell you from the perspective of age. Well, actually, you played with me at Spazio's a few times.
Right, yeah.
The long lost and lamented Spazio.
Right, yeah.
It's very hard to play original jazz anywhere in the city that is not an experimental venue, you know, to begin with, where people don't know that, okay, this is what I've come to hear. Mm-hmm. The list of places that have closed in the last couple of years... Spazio, Charlie O's, someplace else whose name I can't remember. Pretty much places where people went to hear either jazz standards or songbook standards, that kind of music. If you tried to play anything original, you'd be pretty much given the cold shoulder very quickly.
Mm.
If you tried to do it on the bandstand, you would probably not be invited back. Mm-hmm. And going to get those gigs, people would say, well, what are you going to play? And if you didn't play, oh, we're going to play Gershwin, sir. You pretty much wouldn't get the gig. You know, LA has lent itself in jazz anyway to being a little bit of a closed circle in that mm-hmm. way. There's really not a big audience. Right. And this goes all the mm-hmm. way back to the days when Shelley's Manhole was the, you know, the main club.
Mm. You see.
And through the days of Dante's and, you know, Chadney's and all these clubs that are gone.
Right. I obviously there's an amazing history of music here.
Right.
And a tradition. And like a lot of other instances, you know, anything that seeks to change or break out of, you know, the existing structure, what's happened, you know, that's a lot of times that's not well received, you know, and very understandable for anyone that's trying to run an establishment. You know, you really want to connect with the widest audience possible.
Right.
And of course, that's going to be people that have been listening to jazz for a long time.
Yeah. And expect to hear the same tunes.
Sure, right, sure. Right. You know.
And some of those, and a lot of those are great tunes, I mean, should be said. You know?
Oh, mm-hmm. Of course. Yeah. What I was saying earlier, I didn't want to, you know, denigrate any the old standards. I mean, that's my bread and butter. That's what I love to play that stuff. But mm-hmm. I, you know, at the same time, it's like it is when you're writing original stuff that is not in the style of those old standards, mm-hmm. that becomes a tougher tougher niche to get played at the club.
And of course, the guys who were writing what we now think of as the old standards were writing original music.
Right.
You know, they were writing for Broadway primarily, but they were mm-hmm. writing original things, and they had the same problems getting heard that that you do and I do. And you know,
right. Yeah. There was a. I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago, there was that tribute to Jimmy Weibel before he died. Everyone was freaked out because they thought he had passed away when they announced the tribute. But just remember reading about some stories about him, you know, trying to do his own original music, and they just really wanted to play this Western swing thing that he pioneered, you know, and essentially play cowboy music, you know.
I studied with Jimmy Weibel.
Oh, you did? Yeah, okay. Yeah. And you know, and I was just thinking, wow, it's the same phenomena that's happened, you know, throughout time. There's yeah. always been a new thing that's challenged the old thing.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's ever going to go away. Yeah. I mean, that's true in politics and culture and every other thing. It's just we happen to be involved in a music that needs to improve by doing original things, but commercially it's very hard to do those original things in LA. Mm-hmm. It's easier elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But we like the weather out here. So, right. so we stay here yeah, rather than right. starving in New York and playing the loft scene.
Right, right. right. Well, I think, you know, jazz, especially trying to do creative jazz, mm-hmm. that the name itself is a kind of a tricky.
Well, jazz should be created by definition. Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's a pretty, I would say it's a pretty healthy new music scene where the people are improvising, you know, Nels Klein and, right. and Cryptogramophone and, you know, they actually have a pretty broad following, but that I feel like that's almost wholly based on completely breaking away from, you know, any sort of tradition that right. existed in improvised music to that point.
Well, and of course, Nels doesn't make his living playing in those playing that music.
True,
he makes
yeah,
a living
right.
playing a rock and roll band.
Right. Exactly,
a good
yeah,
one,
yeah.
And a great band. It's interesting because Wilco is a very experimental band now by the standards of, you know, the people mm-hmm. they hang out with.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably at least partially because of Nels coming in. But
yeah.
It's they're never going to be a number one band, nor do they want to be. They're never going to be a number one commercial band. I think there's a through line there.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at the left end of anything, when you're too far on the edge of anything,
mm-hmm.
your commercial possibilities are limited. But artistically, you can grow.
Yeah, yeah. I think the challenge for everybody in this town was to believe that there are enough people that really like to hear progressive jazz mm-hmm. music, you know, that was something that you really could not find even just a few years ago, like
right.
like a community of people. And I think one of the probably the greatest success of our thing that we've been doing is to realize that there are people out there, you know, mm-hmm. like you, if you can concentrate enough players
mm-hmm.
that are interesting to those people, they actually come out in droves,
right.
you know. And then like this month alone, you know, at the Blue Whale,
right.
you know, you've seen lines out the door. You know, people can't get in to see this music because mm-hmm. everyone's coming to see it.
Well,
know?
We were talking off mic about Gilad Hexelman's show, the
right.
New York guitar player mm-hmm. who was here last month, and I was there
yeah.
for one night, and it was very crowded. I mean, we got there early. And had we not gotten there early, we would have either not gotten in or we would have been so far back that, you know, we wouldn't have been there.
Absolutely.
Frankly, I was surprised. I was surprised to see that many people there, mm-hmm. especially because Gilad had been here for a week and doing various things connected mm-hmm. with the NAMM yeah. show and doing.
Well, he did something with
showcase.
Us too, actually.
Yeah.
For one of our residencies, the Wednesday before
right.
his show, he played on one of our things. And that was, you know, well attended. Mm-hmm. And that was a Wednesday night.
That's what I mean. He didn't dilute the audience. Whereas I think maybe 10 years ago, someone like that coming here who's not a big commercial name
mm-hmm.
in L.A., playing that many shows would have diluted the audience,
yeah.
but he mm-hmm. didn't. You know, there were people there. I mean, there were people there for the second show even on Saturday.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's another problem down here is LA is not a late night city, and it's not a city where there's an abundance of public transportation to get you home if you've had perhaps one too many adult
yeah.
beverages.
Right.
So there's a lot of things. It's very different here than it is in Chicago, New York,
mm-hmm.
even
mm-hmm.
Nashville, different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of structural things that
right.
make it different, and also the lack of close proximity
mm-hmm.
of clubs that would be doing similar things, you
right.
know, like if mm-hmm. there was one, even if there was another place in that mall, that's
there was
Blue
a
Wells,
scene yeah, yeah
you know, like you actually could have even more people coming and you know, maybe there would be more taxis
right.
you know, right around the area
right.
you know, things like that.
Well, you can find a taxi if you want to go from the Blue Whale to, I don't know, the Music Center or something, that you can get a taxi. If you want to go from Downey to the Blue Whale,
right.
A taxi is a big investment.
Sure, yeah,
yeah, right.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, then maybe if you're a jazz fan, you won't live in Downey. You know, you know, if you're one of the things that maybe will change in the next 10 years or so is that the downtown area, you know, it's already in the process of being revitalized,
right.
and there's new condos and people are moving into it. Like it could actually end up, you know, similar to maybe a Greenwich Village
like
type
an art
of scene.
Yeah.
yeah, and so you'd have a critical mass of people right there.
Right, you know, audience and the music are in the same place.
Yeah. And it would actually be this standalone community within the greater Los Angeles area, you know, and you know, maybe it'll center around Little Tokyo and the Blue Whale.
Right.
If there could be another club that would try to do something like that, you know.
Is there room for another club? Do you think there's enough audience for another club to do what they're doing at the Blue Whale?
I think so, yeah. I definitely think so. I think you know, June has kind of really shown that doing that is feasible and it's possible, and, yeah. and I don't think it, I mean, when they first started out there at June, when June started the club, I think a lot of the people that they would get in there were not necessarily jazz fans, and but they have a tendency to get those people coming back because they came in for the, you know, it looks like a nice hip bar,
right.
and you know, the bartenders are great.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great place. The bartenders are great. The food is good. The seating is original, and
it's a fun place.
Yeah.
And then it's like you have repeat customers because they liked what was going on.
Yeah, it's a good hang.
It's a great hang. And then, you know, I think too, for we know as musicians, like a lot of us go out and see jazz music, and a lot of us are our own audience, right? I mean, we love to go see the music,
yeah.
and it's very affordable to go to the Blue Whale, you know, and drop $10 or $15 for a cover,
yeah.
And I'm sure if there was another place that opened up similar, you know, with a similar kind of business model,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure they would probably do all right too. You know, I think June has really done a good job in showing what's kind of possible.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. If you build it, they will come.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, it's an incredible risk on his part because he didn't have a model in mind. Like, I need to make X amount of money. He frankly just loves music, and
right.
and he wanted to do something to help all of this. These great musicians, you know, that lived in the area, you know, but I think like Ryan was saying, you know, it's a good start, mm-hmm. I think, is because I think people now know that there are people that even like this stuff, you know,
yeah.
And before that we didn't really know, mm-hmm. if that was the case.
Yeah.
It's a good way to find out. I think there needs to be a scene. I think that in order for that to really work, there needs to be more than one place, mm-hmm. or else it's not really viable. It's just one person doing one thing.
Exactly.
And right. that's sort of easy to, it's easy to make that, to minimize the importance of that. Mm-hmm. When it's two clubs or three clubs or five clubs, then you can say, well, this is definitely something that people should pay attention to.
Right.
And
right.
then, of course, there's a possibility of festivals, of the Newport Jazz Party that's coming in next weekend, which is, you know, a real showcase for traditional swing, bebop, post-bop, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The idea for that is that there's a place, there's enough musicians, there's enough fans, there's enough well-heeled fans to spend a weekend at the Newporter.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a scene. Everybody knows what the scene is, and everybody knows kind of who's in it.
Mm-hmm.
There
right.
has to be more than one attraction. There has to be more than one center, or more than one. There have to be nodes at the center mm-hmm. to make
right.
up a scene.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could think of... you know, Microsoft bailing out Apple, you know, like mm-hmm. they, you know, it seems so strange that they would want something else, but
right.
just to have something to play off of.
Yeah, have competition.
You know, that would be a great thing. And, mm-hmm. you know, plus, you know, if you have it very close to each other, if you have the two or three clubs, you know, within walking distance, you know, that seems to me to be...
Well,
ideal. Something
most cities have something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, New York has a village.
Right.
Toronto has Yonge Street. You know, Chicago has Wells Street, although it's not what it was. But in the old days, you know, all the blues clubs were on Wells Street, and everybody, mm-hmm. the artists and the audience went from club to club to club and listened.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we all know Greenwich Village, you know, is still somewhat that way.
Right.
L.A. had the Sunset Strip, but even so, there's not a tradition of going... You know, leaving the Whiskey and going to the Roxy, I mean, that just doesn't, people don't really do that. Every place is a destination.
Mm, right.
Mm. So did you guys, just individually, did you feel you were having problems getting a gig? We kind of spoke to this, but I mean, getting a gig from another club, you just felt that it was just not ever going to happen. Did you try and fail? What's your experiences with that? And then I'll tell you mine.
Well, my experience, one of the great things about being part of the jazz collective for me was that I was more of a closet composer.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know you were a composer. We've worked together.
Right. And so when I became a part of the jazz collective, mm-hmm. It kind of enabled me to have my music played. Before I was a member of the collective, I didn't bother to ask, club owners. Well, I guess at Cafe Metropole when that was around, I had a couple gigs there. But before we had the collective going, mm-hmm. but I never really bothered to have my music played, like say at Spazio,
right.
Because I knew that's not what they really wanted to hear, and I was okay with it. It's not like I was begrudging Spazio right. for that, because I knew what kind of audience they right. wanted.
We knew what we were there for. Yeah,
yeah, and I mean, like Gary was saying earlier too, it's like I never really I can understand why a club owner does not want that music a lot of times. It's unfamiliar, and it's not that it can be not friendly for the audience,
not commercial, yeah.
right. It can be downright scary sometimes, mm-hmm. When like my experience was that it just becoming part of the collective enabled me to have the confidence to go out there and have my music played mm-hmm. and have an audience for my music,
Gary, did you ever try and get gigs at the more traditionally minded places and try and say, well, I'm going to come in and play original music?
No, I think when I, when did I come here? I came here in 2005, mm-hmm. I guess. And then I think we started the collective maybe in 2008 or 2000. Mm-hmm. So I always felt like a relative newcomer here, compared yeah. to people who have been here for decades and everything. I guess my own history was rather unique in that I started to play at this jam session at this other place downtown mm-hmm. Called Second Street Jazz. That was at the time there was an old guy who played trumpet, Mr. Matsumoto was his mm-hmm. name, and he was actually dying of cancer, and that's why he opened the club, because he just wanted to have a place
right.
that he'd always
he bucket was, list
yeah he had some other business before yeah. that import business or something like that, and so he wanted to spend the last years of his life just having jazz in his club. And then of course the club did so poorly, and he actually survive longer than he thought he was going to live. That he had to, but now he had this club, he had to keep it going, so right. it ended up becoming more of a rock club, mm-hmm. and even now that he's gone, his son is doing that, but it's more of a rock venue than a jazz club. While I was there, I started to play with my own trio there, right. And then also start to book other people that I knew were great players, mm-hmm. And I think that eventually so you, became the foundation.
So for you didn't try to go into Charlie O's or Concerts by the Sea that's long gone. The Lighthouse or any of those places.
No. I kind of came into the city, really, really as an outsider.
Right.
And I'll be the first to admit that, I also realistically kind of knew that I probably wouldn't have much of a shot of getting a gig at a place like that,
yeah.
Without having a reputation, and that actually is a dilemma for a lot of younger musicians, mm-hmm. who are quite talented and very well deserving, mm-hmm. but no one knows who they are.
Did you feel like you didn't want to play the standard jazz repertoire, or it just didn't come up, or were you actively opposed to it, or it just was just not something that discussion that never got started?
Yeah, no, it has nothing to do with the kind of music. I love to play standards, and my trio still that's a big part of what we do. Mm-hmm. I think it really is more has more to do with just feeling like, well, who am I to be trying to take a gig away from someone like Pete Chrisleeb,
yeah,
or Alan Pasqua, or any number of guys that actually have a reputation here,
right.
And there are that many clubs to begin with.
So a few years ago, there was a place I used to play all original music down in the Marina del Rey called the Coffee Emporium, which I think is, it's either gone as a music venue or it may be gone altogether, but it was a coffee place. They didn't serve any alcohol. They had baked goods and sandwiches and coffee. They roasted their own coffee. It was quite good. Wow. And they had music on Fridays and Saturdays, and I played there with what at the time was my quartet. We played all original music, and it was very well received, and nobody ever said, oh, why aren't you guys playing, you know, Gershwin or Cole Porter or anything like that. There were a couple little places in the 80s primarily, 80s and 90s, and they were off the beaten path. There was that. There was, believe it or not, Jax used to encourage people to come in and play originals. And the whole thing, I think, at Jax was if you didn't disturb the people eating and drinking, then it didn't matter what you played, you know, which is, as far as I'm concerned, that's a benevolent policy. I can live with that, you know.
Well, that actually underscores the one of the great dilemmas of being a jazz musician is that I think a lot of times the venues that will even have jazz in the first place will have it as a maybe a side effect of the overall ambiance of the club.
Right.
You know, oh yeah, we'll have coffee and then we'll have jazz here, and you know, as long as it's not like scaring people away.
Well, yeah, but there's always a caveat. We'll have jazz as long as it's the kind of jazz we want to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's kind of what they say. Or there aren't too many places with a very eclectic booking policy. Maybe Typhoon is the one that comes to mind, where they pretty much will have any kind of jazz. They have very commercial stuff, and then they have very not very far out stuff, but fairly far out stuff as well. But there aren't too many places.
Well, and that's certainly, you know, the prerogative of the owner of the establishment.
Absolutely.
You know, they I mean, June really likes a very specific kind of thing. June Lee from the Blue Well, and you know, but another larger issue is that sometimes the jazz is not even the main thing,
right?
You know, I guess you could say, you know, there are places that can afford to have jazz, and that means that their business is doing well enough where they can splurge.
Yeah, basically they're selling enough food and liquor.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, but then that means that it really if times get tough or they decide to change, you know, their budget, you know, then they can cut it out, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not a priority of them, but then those are the only places that really can afford to take a risk.
Right.
You know, whereas other places that make it all about the music, you know, if it doesn't work out, then they have nothing else to fall back on.
Well, live music is always the first thing to go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very seldom that these clubs, jazz clubs, carry on just as a club without the music. I mean, Charlie O's is a good example. They just, that was basically the focus there was the music, and they couldn't make it, and that was the end of that.
Mm. Yes, yeah. And, you live by the sword and you die by the sword.
Yeah.
And that's terrifying. You know, if I can't even imagine, you know, having to take out a loan and then having to tell my creditors, well, I'm basing it off of this music that is not that popular, you know? You know, that said, I think that there's another issue, which is the liquor license. You know, it's a lot easier to get a liquor license if you bill yourself as a jazz club as opposed to a rock club.
Right.
So if you want to be a live music venue, you know, but you're trying to do it on the cheap, I guess, it would be better to say that you were a jazz club and then, you know, sort of have jazz, but then, you know, maybe branch out into blues or other things, you know. And so then, you know, you're kind of semi-obligated to have jazz, but then maybe you don't really want to have jazz. And so as a musician, sometimes you get that sort of mixed signal.
Well, the good thing about jazz in terms of that is it can be very loosely defined. There's a lot of different things. We've all played things that are, we know what jazz is. It's kind of like pornography. You know what it is when you see it, but it's hard to define it, paraphrasing the Supreme Court. But there's a lot of things that fit into a loose definition of jazz. And that can be sometimes, you know, a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that can be not a good thing because, you know, you think about the Baked Potato, who I certainly have nothing against, but I mean, that's a place where you can go and play original music, but it has to fit into their idea of, it's basically a fusion club.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an acoustic music, hard jazz club.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, most people who are playing there are playing original music.
That's very true.
You know, and so it's a contradiction. It's sort of the contradiction that proves what we're talking about in a way, because while they're not particularly picky about, you know, you must play this song and that song and all that, they are fairly picky about what they define as what fits into the club.
Yeah. In a way, that
A quick plug. I'm actually playing at the Baked Potato a week from Sunday, so February 19th, with Jason Harnell, member of the LA Jason. Jazz Collective, and Larry Koontz.
Right, so. That's a good. See, that seems like an unlikely trio for the Baked Potato.
It is. Yes, they put us on, but we were playing. Jason does like I think once every month or once every 2 months. They give him a spot on a Sunday night and. Yeah, we do kind of acoustic jazz there, but I think we're like about the only, one of the only groups pretty that does much. That. Yeah.
I guess I don't know what is the name of the guy that runs the place there?
The piano player. I played in the Baked Potato Band.
I'm not sure.
Because it seems like every now and then he'll you know, try something different. Adam Rogers was there.
That's
recently,
right. Yeah.
You know, with a pretty progressive group. Jonathan Kreisberg used to play there with his organ trio, you know, with Gary Versace and Mark Ferber. It's not entirely.
It's not
way,
entirely.
Yeah, there is a general thing that happens there, which would be the bread and butter for his club, you know, and probably what he likes.
Because, I mean, you don't think of that group as being representative. You think of you know, Steve Lukather and that kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Jazzy rock, rocky jazz.
Yeah.
But it is original music primarily that people play there. So it's a different. Yeah. It's a different strain on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was one of the early debates about our own thing. You know, like we had these discussions on how inclusive we wanted to be. You know, do we want to include all kinds of music and all kinds of people?
Right.
You know, or should we really try to consolidate or discover, you know, what is sort of the sound that we wanted to represent?
And how do you define that, or do you bother to define it?
I think it's defined itself. You know,
like
if you listen to the sampler CD,
right?
There is a even though the music is fairly eclectic, you know, they're also, I think, you know, you can tell it's not a fusion thing,
right?
You know, it's not a standards thing. It's it kind of is its own thing, and I guess. Like any community or a subculture, you know, you're going to end up having like-minded people gravitate to a larger thing. So
the thing is, though, if you want to grow, I mean, I don't know if you want to grow or not, but I mean, if you want to grow, you can't define it. Eventually, you can't define it merely by the people that are in it.
Certainly not.
Because with the minute somebody else says, oh, excuse me, can I join the collective? Then that's automatically somebody new, or maybe you don't want new people. I don't know.
That was a really heated discussion, I think, you know, in the early going. You know, we quickly found that we had many more people that wanted to be a part of it than we had.
I noticed you have associate members and things. Is that how you handle that? Or
that was our initial attempt to be or try to thread the needle of you know, I think there were 13. You can almost call them the founding fathers of our collective.
Are there founding mothers as well, or is it all male?
There are we have one member, but not she wasn't part of the original 13, but a great saxophone player named Ariel Alexander, fantastic player actually, and you know, not by I personally, you know, do not want to be exclusive of anybody, and I think what's kind of happened over the years that we've existed is that, you know, we really have included quite a few people from, you know, a pretty broad spectrum of the community around here, on our festivals. Operationally, I think we've kept it fairly, close to the members, that we started with. But I do see it, being not so much of a membership. You know, like you don't need to join a club,
right?
You know, to be a
like-minded
participant.
People,
yeah. Because we're hopefully going to be able to branch out to do a lot more events. We actually have a label now, Jazz Collective Records, you know, we want it to be really more about the music. You know, if the music is similar to, I guess, something that we can relate to, in terms of the way that it sounds, then hopefully that we'd find a place for that somewhere, you know, in our collective. We are changing our model as well, you know, going from what was at the time a partnership, you know, in terms of our business model. Yeah. We're transferring over to just being a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. So structurally, we're kind of in transition right now. Oh, it's a plane.
Are either of you running from the law? Is that the circling here?
Right? Yeah, this is a good place to hide, actually. Though. It is. Windows are shut. You know, yeah. No one knows we're here.
Right. Well, they will when this hits the website. What's the advantage of being a collective as opposed to a bunch of guys who just can, you know, email each other and say, hey, let's get together? I mean, what's the advantage of having a formal partnership as opposed to not?
Well, I think it's... we're going the direct. It gives us more momentum, I think, mm-hmm. with the formality of it. Because, like Gary was saying, it's like now that we're going in the direction of becoming a nonprofit, it's like we wouldn't be able to do that, I think, with just, you know, a series of emails and
right.
and just word of mouth type thing. And by making it more of a formal group, a more of a formal community, I think it gives us a little more purpose, and makes us stronger. It's mm-hmm. like when we put on a festival, or when, you know, we have, like Gary said, a record label that goes along with that. It's like, yeah. we have if we put on a festival, the club will probably have a couple good nights, you know, if we do it.
Right.
So it gives us a little more. It's like strength in numbers, mm-hmm. you know. It gives us a little more force. So
I think one thing that we have now that we didn't have before is a name that people are familiar with.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. as an individual, you know, we would be in the same boat that we were, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but
yeah.
then you can say, well, the LA Jazz Collective is doing this. You know, that's actually already been something that we've enjoyed. People, you know, come to our website and they look for our events, you know, mm-hmm. people are joining our email list. And yeah, it's, it is greater than the sum of our parts.
Mm. Well, that's gotta be the point. Otherwise it's not worth giving up the individuality.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. What events do you have coming up? I mean, how are you going to render this? How are you going to prove, you know, prove your worth as an organization? 'Cause there's nothing on your website today.
We just finished our residency in January. We tend to we've been fairly I don't know what you call it, conservative in our the amount of things we've done as of late. Partially because we've been trying to restructure as a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. So that most of our energy has been kind of entailed in trying to do that.
Right, so getting it out of the way.
But, you know, hopefully this year we're looking to really make steps in that. Like, we have our paperwork ready to go. And this year is kind of going to be kind of a, I don't know what you call it, like a reset for our organization, you
right.
know, like, you know, you're looking at our website, which is kind of yeah. embarrassing because there's, like you said, there's nothing on there.
Well, I mean, actually the last entry is January 25th, which is, as we record this, is 3 weeks ago. So that's not too very bad.
Mm-hmm.
If I was you, I'd probably want to see something coming up.
Right.
You know? But,
right,
but like
yeah,
you say, your energy is going elsewhere.
You know, but we hope to, you know, we're just in talks, really, to do stuff maybe gearing up towards the end of the year.
Yeah.
There's a possibility of working with Rocco Samazzi to maybe do something for the Angel City Jazz Festival.
That would be cool.
There might be a summer thing that we're doing. And hopefully what we can do this year is also have a fundraising drive. You know, maybe it would be a series of concerts, mm-hmm. you know, that we can get everyone to contribute their time and their compositions too.
Yeah.
You know, and then start to actually, you know, think of ourselves, you know, as an arts organization.
Right.
And not just a loose collection of jazz musicians that do things every now and then. You know, so we're still in transition.
Yeah. Is there any plan to take this elsewhere out of LA or into the suburbs even of LA? I mean, could there be a Downey Jazz Collective that would, you know, operate as a subsidiary of you, or an Orange County Jazz Collective, or
a franchise.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking.
We don't have any plans, but that's a very good idea.
Are most of your members from like the loose LA area, or are there people from outlying? One of the things about LA that I think militates against this kind of thing is just the sheer geographical weight of it. You know, there's just everything. I mean, LA is everything from Antelope Valley down to, you know, northern San Diego.
Right, yeah, we have some members from Orange County that are in the collective too.
Yeah,
there's a few from the Inland Empire and then come out. One thing that we have talked about in the past was to do regional festivals. So like maybe we could go down to Orange County to Irvine, or maybe even San Diego, or go up into or go east, you know, go into Inland Empire, Riverside, you know, San Bernardino, and right. maybe be able to collaborate with the musicians that are there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe bring one or two groups from LA and then, you know, kind of pair them up,
right.
you know, and you know, we found that the festival model has been, or the mini festival model, it's usually one or two nights where we have a lot of groups playing, you know, that's actually been really successful, not just in terms of bringing people out, but also getting musicians to meet each other, you know, like people that you didn't really know or maybe just heard about, you know, through the grapevine. That would definitely be something we'd like to do. We're also thinking about maybe putting together a tour eventually, you know, maybe one or two groups that we could bring to another city,
right.
maybe up to my hometown in Seattle.
Because the San Francisco Jazz group does that. I forget what they call themselves. Is it San Francisco Jazz Collective?
Yeah.
I think it is.
And they put basically a group on the road and say, this is us, and they tour under that name.
Yeah, their collective is... just a band created by SF Jazz, which is their arts organization, you know.
I'm a member.
Oh, great. Cool. But yeah, that enables them to have more than a local reach. Like they can go on tour and people know about them and the organization.
Mm-hmm. And they've got some pretty big name players.
Involved
in that too.
Yeah, that is great.
So how did it become more than just a bunch of guys sort of saying, we got to do something about this? How did it become the LA Jazz Collective? I mean, was that...
Well, I think it's probably you and Matt, really.
Matt Otto?
Yeah.
Yeah, really, I think it most of it should go to Matt. I think this is something that he's been thinking about for years, you know, of wanting to do a collective, and that was his terminology from the beginning. Like he really believes in the concept of a community that is really tight and really shares, you know, what they have to give, you know, and creating something that together, you know, would be a much better and stronger force, you know, to do the things that we would hope to do.
Right.
And so, you know, he knew what I was doing over at that other place, at Second Street Jazz, and then he actually approached me and said, you know, would you help me start this new organization that he's thinking? And so he invited a lot of people, most of the friends that he played with, and actually invited quite a few people, you know, to just meet once, you know, just to talk about what could happen. And I think those meetings eventually, I think we talked about it for maybe could have been close to a year, actually. You know, we would meet maybe once a month or so and just talk about what was possible. And then we actually ended up creating the organization and then doing a launch festival, which was in two different places, a Friday and Saturday. Friday was at the now defunct Pasadena Jazz Institute.
Right.
And then Saturday night was at Cafe Metropole, which also was not doing jazz.
Yeah. So, although I'm sure neither of those things went under because of the LA Jazz Collective.
No, hopefully we didn't.
Just a coincidence.
Of course.
A coincidence.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want anything should happen to your club. So... What formulated question around that? There was an article about you guys in the LA Times about a month ago. Did you get a bump in interest from that? Did it? Can you tell the difference, or did that pretty much just not resonate?
You know, I think it's probably a longer road than we do see bumps on our traffic, you know, mm-hmm. on our website, you know, especially centered around when the articles are released and all that. That was actually a we'd already had our first show, and then after
the residency,
and after the fact, I think there was so much buzz after the first show that they felt compelled to write something. Mm-hmm. You know, so
because the Times does at the moment anyway a crappy job, I think, of covering jazz.
They could have a little bit more resource on it. Although Chris Barton is an amazing jazz writer and jazz critic, and right. they're really glad that.
Oh, he's a good
there.
Writer.
Yeah,
but you know he doesn't write jazz full time, and there's nobody really. The listings mm-hmm. are terrible.
Yeah,
you know? I mean the on the website it's good, but the printed LA Times the listings are just, you know, you would not know there's any jazz in the
yeah.
city at all if
yeah.
you went by that.
Yeah, it's tough, right? The print. All around is tough. You know, the Weekly is tough. Rick Wall is not writing for the Weekly
right.
anymore. You know, and you have to kind of dig in to find things that are happening. You know, that's one area that we're hoping will be something that we could help as well. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, you know, we try to send out to our list. You know, just events that are happening around town.
Yeah,
and
become a clearinghouse.
Yeah, just to promote on things. I think I'll probably do a piece for the Jason Harnell's thing at the Baked Potato pretty mm-hmm. soon. And every now and then I also get people asking me to, you know, if I would plug a certain show that's coming into town, you know. And actually recently I've been writing for the LA Weekly. I've been doing preview picks for them as well. So
that's good.
I try not to have a conflict. Like I wasn't actually, I'm not sure, but they didn't assign any of our own residency mm-hmm. Concerts, you know, for me to write about,
yeah.
you know, maybe that would
yeah.
seem awfully, you know, not good. So, yes. you know, but nevertheless, you know, at least on our own blog and our website, you know, we can do a better job of highlighting interesting events.
Mm-hmm. But you have to get people there. You still have to get people to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that has to come through larger media. I mean, if the Times article had steered a lot of people to your website, then you would have people to whom, you know, to whom you could speak. If they're not there, then it's mm-hmm. still a problem getting it out.
Well, yeah, it's hard to know how much of that translates. I guess there might be some hard numbers that we could really pour through and see what exactly kind of effect does that have. You know, we do know that all four of our nights, Wednesday nights in January at the Blue Whale, were really well attended.
That's a good thing.
You know, we had full houses for all four nights. And you know, hopefully the Times article had something to do with it. We also got a nice review for the second week in the LA Weekly. Mm-hmm. So we did get some press from that. We're thankful for that.
Yeah. Mm. So where do you see jazz in LA is going? I know that's a big question, and it's hard to be a pundit, but what's your view of it? You think there's going to be more clubs, less clubs? Do you think clubs will lose relevancy?
I don't know if clubs will lose their relevancy. They might fail.
they always do eventually.
Sometimes I think there's a disconnect between the relevancy of a club, you know, to the music scene and the success of the club. Case in point would be Rocco Samazzi and the various iterations of everything that he's done.
Yeah,
you know, his own clubs
from
did not
Hollywood to downtown to, or for actually from
Bel Air,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
right,
yeah.
You know, and then at Metropole, and of course Rocco's going to be doing this great project up in Oakland mm-hmm. now, and
oh,
hopefully
really?
That will be. Yeah, he's already moved up to Oakland.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This is breaking news. Rocco's moving to Oakland.
Oh, well, I mean, it's great for Rocco.
But yeah, there'll be a brand new kind of Yoshi's type of situation there, where he's going to be the manager and the music coordinator for the whole place.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. At Yoshi's, or you mean at another club?
Another club that
okay.
would be,
but a similar
the model would be Yoshi's. Yeah,
right.
I guess there's a, I can't remember the name of the chef, but he's like a really, almost like a celebrity type chef that just really loves crazy music.
Oh,
and,
great.
And so he lured Rocco away from LA to do that. But yeah, you know, it really seems to be incumbent upon the people that are hosting musicians, you know, to just want to do it at all costs, you know, regardless of the risk, the economic risk associated with it, you know, and for that reason, you're really always, it's always going to be an uphill battle, you know, to try to get anybody to do that. I mean, it seems like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're actually in that position where you have to pay your staff every week and take out loans to pay your staff, you know, you have rent due, you know, there's such a tremendous amount of expense, you know.
Oh, yeah, it's a very tough business.
Yeah, you know, and I can understand why club owners get really uptight, you know, and sometimes the relationships with the artists aren't that good, because I think from the artist side, we don't see that side of it enough. Yeah. But one thing we are seeing recently, maybe through the Blue Whale, is that there can be a tremendous amount of potential, you know, for getting more people in, you know, and if the Blue Whale can figure out a way to translate that into more money that comes in the club, you know, more power to it. And I think that's maybe what hopefully that would be an example for other people who might want to try to do that.
Yeah, because you have to wonder, I mean, the Blue Whale for LA is so unique that you have to wonder, is that a thing that just is not really reproducible? It's a one-time thing because of the location and the audience and all that, or is this something that could happen all over town or even all over downtown?
I think it really depends on the individual.
June, because he loves the music so much, he's just all in.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter. I don't think he wants the club to succeed, but it's like he's put his cards on the table. He's all in.
Yeah.
I mean, that's his deal. And I mean, because of that, it's like as a musician, it's like you trust him, you have this respect and rapport with him that you know, it's like he's always looking out for the greater interest of us, and so we do the same for him. It's like when I, and this is even away from the Jazz Collective, it's like when I go in to the Blue Whale with a group, sure enough, that group is going to be sounding good. It's like there's going to be some creative effort that we've put in on the work that we're going to present in there.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be a featured group. And we don't want to let down June. But I mean, it's not even that. It's more like he trusts us enough. He's asked us to come in and play music. It's a privilege to do that for him.
Right.
And so when we go and do it, it's like we present our best work. I mean, I don't think I've ever gone in there with like kind of a slack attitude or anything, you know?
Well, that's the attitude that you have when the music is the focus, when you're going in there to present the music and it's not background music, because it definitely isn't there. Then that gives you a very different attitude than when you're going into play for people, you know, and you know you've got to keep it below the level of the conversation. You have all these, you know, these things you have to do to even get the gig. At a place like the Blue Whale, where the focus is on the music and and it's presented as an art form, then you want to try harder. You
know? Right. And, you know, it's, I think I had a teacher of mine tell me once, you know, we don't get into playing jazz for a house in the hills, right? You know, and it's like, it took me, you know, a long time to accept that.
Well, see, that's one of the things about LA that's unique. And we've, almost everyone who's been on this podcast, we've had some sort of discussion about, is jazz in LA even a possible way, you know, to make a living? What's going to happen to the future? What's going to happen to the clubs? The very first episode I did with Roy McCurdy, Roy had been the house drummer and in the trio at Charlie O's, and that was a good gig for years, for 10 years, you know. And he was there the last night, too, when Mrs. Charlie O just basically said, that's it, goodbye. So nobody's going to get rich playing this music, but that's definitely part of it. But in L.A., you have a lot of musicians, most of whom are not here to play jazz, most of whom are here to play in the studios or to play commercial music of one kind or another. And maybe they play jazz and maybe they don't. Maybe they'll go out and support people playing original jazz. Maybe they won't. Most often they won't. But it's not the focus of the musicians who are here. So it's an odd situation. And the actors that I know complain about the same thing, that there's a lot of actors here because the business of film is here. But it's a very hard theater town. It's hard to put on serious theater because that's not what people are here to do. and people don't stay out late. And I mean, all the things we know about LA. And of course, if you're listening to this in Anchorage, you don't know this stuff. But but it's a tough town that way. It's an early to bed town. We don't have the public transportation. Taxi cabs are very expensive. All those things that we know, they're not abstract. I mean, they're really a problem. You know, they are really a problem. And I don't know that those things can be surmounted, or I think that they can, but I don't know that they can be surmounted unless other things change at the same time. I don't think you can just change one thing, you know?
Yeah. You know, although we're hoping that there can be things that would be catalysts, you know, for a change.
That would be the point, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly a place like the Blue Whale has been a really good catalyst.
Yeah.
You see guys coming, like Elad Helkselman, for instance, you know, coming out from New York specifically to play at this place. You know, it's before, you know, they... You talk to some of these guys from New York, and they say, you know, we would never try to play in L.A. There's just really
most people, and again, we've talked about this in other podcasts too. But most of the national or international acts that we get here are either on their way to Japan or on their way from Japan, and they stop in L.A. and they do a couple of nights, and then they, as quickly as possible, go back to New York or Boston or wherever they're from, and they don't come out here just to play here. You know, and even it's interesting, we don't get a big bump after the Monterey Jazz Festival, I'm old enough to remember that after Monterey, acts would then come down here and they would play the Lighthouse and Concerts by the Sea or Shelley's or whatever, or maybe do a concert somewhere. That's gone. That doesn't happen anymore.
I see.
You know, it's only the traffic before Japan and after Japan. It's really not.
It's not a destination.
It's not a jazz destination for most people. And when they come, they generally play Catalinas, and then they leave, you know, play 3 or 4 days, and then they go out, if they can sell out Catalinas.
Yeah, yeah. You know, maybe there's varying levels of the kind of talent that come in as well, and I'm sure Catalinas will be around for a while because their model is set up to be able to house, you know, really, really big acts, you know.
Yeah.
Jazz celebrities, if there even is a thing.
Yeah, but that's a big place with high ceilings and a lot of lights to turn on and a lot of people to heat or cool.
Yeah,
you know, it's a large plant.
Right, right.
Another plug. I'll be playing at Catalina on February 29th with Tamir Hendelman.
Oh, great.
Pianist,
awesome.
Come out and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unless you're listening to this next July. That's the thing about podcasting. it's not a serial medium. You know, you don't hear it necessarily when it comes out. There are people who will hear this in 10 years' time and go, oh, I wonder what that gig was like.
Well, I know one thing that June is talking about with Rocco moving up to Oakland, and then I guess maybe the third part of this would be the pianist Wayne Horvitz, who lives up in Seattle. He actually opened up a new venue up there.
Oh, right.
So there you have a tour, L.A. to Oakland to Seattle.
Yeah, with three people who know each other really well.
Yeah.
Like it could be, you know, something that would be a lot easier to make it, feasible, make the numbers work out, you know. So you can see, I was talking to Rocco recently, and I was asking him about the scene in L.A. because he's been here for a while, and he said that he sees it not so much in terms of a large trend, but more in terms of cycles. Like there was a previous cycle where there was a lot of creative music coming, you know, mainly from all the great people that were graduates from CalArts at the time. I think Todd Sickafoos was one of the guys. Willie Jones was just coming out. And maybe even before that, you know, like the LA Jazz Quartet and Larry Koontz and Scott Colley, although he went out to New York later on. But
well, Willie Jones went to New York. The Ferbers went to New York.
Yeah, you know, and so all that talent. Yeah, Ferbers. Yeah, they're a huge part of that. Right. Anthony as well. You know, when all those guys were really young.
When they all worked for me, by the way, as sideline musicians. Everyone I've mentioned has worked for me as a sideline musician.
That's awesome.
Including Ryan.
That's right. Yeah. You know, so he says that, you know, you get sort of a cycle of really great talent that stays in LA for a while and really boosts the scene, and then invariably they go on and do other things. I mean, you see that with Ben Wendell moving out to New York. You know, he's still
he's got a foot in both coasts.
But you know, it obviously the allure of going east is still very strong. You know, and one thing that would have to change would be you know, the ability to have an incentive for someone to say, you know, I'm going to stay here because there's a lot of things happening, you know?
Well, yeah, and it's a two-part question. I mean, can you stay here and make a living? Yeah. Can you stay here? You can make a good living in music in mm-hmm. L.A. and in the environs because we have the studios, we have the film, we have the TV.
Yeah.
We have all that. The second part of that question, can I make a good living in L.A. as a creative musician? Yeah, not so much, you know?
Yeah.
That's difficult. And mm-hmm. being someone who has had, like, three different careers, one career playing, you know, commercial music in the studios and doing that, and then another career playing blues and country and jazz, three very, you know, minimized, not really easy to make a living at kinds of music.
Right.
It's hard. It's really hard here to do something on the edges and make a living at it. If you don't have mm-hmm. money coming in from another source of music, mm-hmm. it's pretty hard. So how do you keep a purely creative musician here? You know, that's the tough question.
Well, it's not to say that it's easy in New York either. I mean, there's a lot of really poor, amazing.
No, it's certainly not easy. I'm not saying that. Yeah. But the difference is there's a artistic, there's a feeling of, at least we're all in this together back there, that you kind of don't have so much here. Maybe you guys will change that. But there's a feeling that, you know, you can be an artist in New York in music. There's a loft scene. There's a scene that sort of supports itself. You're not going to make a lot of money, perhaps. You still have to make money playing club dates or, you know, doing whatever you do. But it's a thing to be an artistic musician in New York that it has not been here, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's been tough to do.
Yeah, very true. Somebody was relaying to me, someone that somebody else said, I'm not going to name any names, about a young player that was really great. I think he was still a student at the time. He was a saxophone player, and then there was this older saxophone player that actually enjoying this guy's playing. And then at the end he said to my friend, you know, well, this guy's great, you know, but he, you know, he's going to move to New York because there's no jazz in L.A.
Yeah.
And then my friend was like, well, the only reason why he said that is because there is jazz in L.A. and this guy is one of the guys that is doing it, and he mm-hmm. doesn't want to create the perception that there is jazz in L.A., you know, where all these people end up coming in and taking away gigs from this other guy.
Oh, well. We should be so lucky as to have that problem. I mean, when musicians start flooding to L.A. because of all the jazz gigs, then you guys will have done something right, you know?
Right.
I don't see that as being a big danger. I mean, most jazz musicians, including the three of us in this room, don't make a living playing jazz per se as much as we make a living either teaching or playing other kinds of music or whatever it's going to be, you mm-hmm. know. It's tough to bring a living out of the music, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in this economic climate, I think it's really difficult. One thing that we're hoping to do going forward, you know, as a nonprofit entity would be to be able to get alternate sources of funding either through patrons, federal funding, you know, we don't know where that's headed, you know, but just to be able to provide support for people and provide an incentive for people to continue to write music mm-hmm. and maybe not have it be a career. Like I don't know if we'll be able to bankroll anybody's career off of that, but at least it would make it economically possible to try.
Maybe scholarships or something mm-hmm. on a small scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a record label's a good beginning. Yeah. SF Jazz is actually building their own building. And, and that's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, that's exciting.
That's amazing.
Yeah, getting back to what you were saying about, you know, it's funny. It's like I think of myself. I consider myself a creative musician, and I don't make my entire living off creative music. But you know, I diversify. It's like I have a couple of teaching gigs that I do. But that's not really the lion's share of my income. I mean, my income is like spread over a vast area of like multiple things that I do.
Right.
And, you know, in any given month, it's a whole series of different things. I still do a lot of club dates. Mm-hmm. I have a regular gig that I do. You know, a couple days a week, I'm at a couple of different colleges. You know, occasional tours, like it's a whole potpourri of things that I do.
Right.
But for me, the one key thing I need to keep me going is like maybe one or two projects a month. And if I have one or two projects, and by project, I mean like, maybe
ongoing.
A gig at, well, not even ongoing. Sometimes if it's just a gig with, somebody coming through town, at the Blue Whale, or, you know, occasionally, you know, like I mentioned that gig with Tamir Hendelman,
right.
If I have that, or, you know, if I have a recording, such, like I just did a recording with Matt Otto and Jason Harnell, if I have something that I'm putting my focus on for that month, you know, it keeps me in that creative mode.
Right.
And, it is like, I don't, I think I'm okay. I'm, as a musician, I'm okay with that. I don't feel the desire, the need to move to New York to become the quote unquote creative musician. I think as long as I have a creative project that, I'm able to put my energy and focus on for the month, then I'm, I mean, that keeps me a happy camper, right. You know?
Yeah, I guess survival is the first.
Oh
step.
Yeah, as a parent,
to not give up and become a banker, I guess is the main thing. But
right,
yeah.
I think one thing that Matt Otto and I were marveling at after the first series of festivals was that all of us really felt like we wanted to write music again.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one thing, you know, as a jazz musician, you can kind of get complacent.
Yeah.
You know, you play a lot of gigs, you know, all sorts of things, weddings, restaurant gigs. You can teach lessons, you know, and you can actually survive, but there isn't really a whole lot of incentive to write your own music and record a project, you know. And I think one thing that the collective has been able to do is at least create some sort of tangible reward for doing so.
Yeah.
Like if someone came and watched and say, I got a new album, and, you know, we want to try to figure out a way to get it out there, you know, and then we do our best to help them get a show, you get their CD reviewed, things like that. And that alone, you know, just knowing that there's an outlet for that would, like Ryan made.
See,
it.
That's what I think is important, is this idea of fostering the idea of being able to create, to do creative music in Los Angeles, not to necessarily have it find the wide audience that you find if you play, you know, you play for one day on a movie session, you make more money, more people are going to hear you. But the idea that you can still be a creative musician, that doesn't just fall into a well somewhere, but that it actually resonates and that other people will hear what you're doing and other people will appreciate what you're doing. And I mean, for me, the reason I didn't move to New York, and this was a big discussion like 30 years ago when I came off the road, the reason I didn't move to New York was not because of the weather, was because in New York, I could play jazz all the time, and there's always club dates and all that, but I knew I wasn't going to be able to play a lot of blues and a lot of country music, which I get a lot of satisfaction from. There was, like, no scene doing that there. New York is very straight ahead. You do this, you do this, you do that. And I didn't want to limit myself that way, so I stayed here. And the sunshine is nice, and it's a good place to raise kids and all that. But the diversity of making a living as a musician in LA works for us in that we can make a living, but it works against us in that you can kind of spread yourself so thinly that you don't write music. And I've been returning to writing music in the last year, and it feels really good.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to look out for here. You know, that's part of the deal. There's but there's a very small limit to most people's attention span for really creative music. And once you've exceeded the limit, man, you know it, you know? So if you guys can do something to reverse that and make it an artistic, make people proud to be artists, you know, as opposed to apologizing for,
here's
this thing I wrote and I hope you like it.
Yeah.
And please don't leave.
Yeah.
Exactly. Please don't leave without having the minimum, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think if you look at the, I guess you would say the new generation, the kids that are in college now.
You young kids with your loud jazz music and your fast cars, your internet.
Yes,
those kids.
Right.
You see a tremendous amount of diversity in their own, their own writing, for instance, but also just what they like to listen to, you know, and it, you know, maybe it's becoming less of a
they don't see barriers in the way that people my age did. I'm older than you. I'm 60. You guys are probably a little more than half that, right?
More than half. I'm going to be 40 this year. So.
Yeah.
I'm 37.
Yeah, you're a little younger.
Yeah, but the
I've got your driver's license on file somewhere. And I'm not afraid to use it.
Yeah.
Well, so none of us are kids, and we all have students. I mean, speaking for myself and probably for you guys, I mean, I have students that amaze me with both the extent of their creativity and their chops and the fact that they listen to a lot of different kinds of music, that they have a very Catholic view of of music mm. that people our age didn't necessarily mm-hmm. have. I know people my age didn't have. I mean, yeah. you were either hard into one style or nobody took you seriously. You know,
I saw it when I was in grad school at Cal Arts. You know, there were people that I studied with that went on to become really great indie rock players. You mm-hmm. know, there's a bassist, Gus Seifert, who ended up playing with Norah Jones at yeah. first, and now he's part of the Black Keys. He's touring all over the place, yeah. you know. But I think one thing that we saw was that the kids that were studying jazz and really creative music, even after they got out of doing that, they brought that type of mentality into their own rock projects, mm-hmm. you know. And I can't help but think, you know, that's actually kind of helped popular music, you know, like yeah. like you're seeing mm-hmm. elements of you know stuff that you would never hear in rock music.
You know
the advances in electronica and using sound effects, just interesting chord progressions, you know. And I have to say that probably comes from just the educational system that a lot of these kids go through before they become rock musicians.
Part of it is a better access to tools. Sure. I mean, you can do a lot more on your own now that right. you know you couldn't do before.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And access to other kinds of music very quickly right. too. Yeah.
So how do people get in touch with the LA Jazz Collective?
Well, through our sort of broken website. That's probably the easiest way to do it.
Your website to me doesn't look broken. It looks fine. Maybe it needs a little more up-to-date content.
Yeah.
LAJazzCollective.com. And up there you've got various tabs for, you profile the artists of the collective and events, and you've got a calendar and a blog and...
Yeah, I don't want to
none of which are working at the moment, by the way. But maybe I wouldn't worry about that.
Yeah, well, we're definitely due for an overhaul, and one of the other things about becoming an organization is actually you have to behave like a real organization.
Right.
So you know, getting staff and hiring people to actually take care of this stuff. Yeah. We can only do so much as jazz musicians. You right. know, we're always going to be focused on making music.
Well, you've got a sampler CD available at CD Baby and also yeah. through your site. So if you go to cdbaby.com/CD/Los Angeles Jazz, you can find the Los Angeles Jazz Collective sampler. And interesting names of tunes. The Golden Molar.
Yeah, that's our
Jamie
resident.
No, this is cool.
The king of interesting titles.
This is cool. Well, I really applaud you guys for trying to do something new and for trying to get the word out and like that, you know. And I appreciate you coming in, Gary yeah. Fukushima, Ryan McGillicuddy.
Thanks glad for to be here. Us. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. All right. See you guys.
All right.